As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
The earnings here in the United States continue to take the headlines, and it's Morgan Stanley this morning smashing estimates with investment banking revenue up 7%, trading revenue for debt trading and equity trading also smashing estimates, and the stock up this morning by 1.8% in the pre-market. I'm pleased to say that joining us to react is Kate Moore, BlackRock Chief Equity Strategist. And on the financials so far, Kate, just to get your thoughts, I'll go through the single names and you can talk about the sector. JP Morgan, they beat, they deliver a record profit, and the stock is down. We saw the same thing with Goldman Sachs. We haven't seen that with Morgan Stanley, but overall, we've seen really, really decent numbers. Yet a market that doesn't seem to be overly impressed. Why do you think that is?
You know, I've heard a host of reasons why the market is reacting so softly to what seemed like very, very strong numbers and very solid expectations for future earnings growth this year. You know, some of them are that deposit betas are rising a little bit, i.e. that there's more competition across the banks for deposits, and so they're having to pass on the benefits of higher rates to their customers. That might be one explanation. Some of it's been that guidance from banks around future growth and loan growth has been a little bit lower. That might be one excuse. To be honest with you, I think the sector is in outstanding shape, and I've been kind of disappointed with how the market has reacted to these exceptionally strong numbers. I think that we need to stay long the financials, and particularly the large cap banks.
Yeah.
And it remains one of my favorite picks throughout this year.
Kate, to what extent is it a market that's just looking at the VIX, pulling back down to a 15 handle and saying, yeah, well done, great first quarter, you're not going to repeat it on the trading side in 2Q?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, look, it takes some skill, though, to be able to really benefit from significantly higher volatility. We had these high vol days and lots of plus and minus 1% intraday moves, much more so than we saw, of course, in 2017, where there was no movement. But volumes weren't huge. And so in order to really take advantage of it, I think you need some skilled traders and you need some great relationships. So I wouldn't say it has to just be about the VIX in order to continue to benefit from the trading side.
Is there an efficient frontier now? I mean, Kate, if we were to wax off theoretical right now, is there a thing out there that's all curvy and stocks and bonds and I know where I want to be and maybe I even know what to do with my cash? Does that theory work still?
I think we've had some sort of evolution in thinking about portfolio construction.
What did we evolve to?
Well, look, we've been in a period where it made sense to hold a significant amount of debt and hold a significant amount of equity at the same time. If we are right about a sustained global economic expansion persisting for the next couple quarters, for the next couple years, that we're not kind of at the end of the cycle and that rates will continue to rise, we need to be pretty thoughtful about how we approach fixed income. You've heard it from us many times, but we prefer short duration. We certainly prefer parts of the emerging market debt world over some of the long duration U.S. treasuries. But I know I sound like a broken record because I'm an equity strategist, but I still strongly believe that equities are the place to be, even this late in the cycle, even if your returns are not going to be north of 20% this year.
But Kate, what's so important here is we forget about, CFA 101, like level one, I'm in a panic and I don't know what this means. You look at weighted average cost of capital. I'm looking at a major famous consumer durable, which will, a staple almost. We'll leave it, the name of it out. It doesn't matter. They've only got 9.1% debt. Mm-hmm. Their cost is modeled at 2.1%, which is a 0.2% contribution to a weighted average cost of capital. This isn't in the theory books.
No, that's right. And this is one of the real challenges, I think, when you're looking forward and trying to put together forecasts, but then you use historical relationships and historic balance sheets and historic, you know, sort of corporate behavior as your guide. That's always this risk, whether you're thinking about asset allocation or whether you're thinking about kind of near-term returns of driving your car by looking through the rearview mirror. And so your point about debt being relatively low, we've talked about this before, about how what a great job companies have done of terming out their debt and locking in low rates and, you know, how less sensitive they are and how healthy I think their balance sheets are relative to, say, where they were, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. We need to be careful about using history too much as a guide.
So, Kate, what are you concerned about most of all? There's no big maturity wall coming up for many of these companies. As you say, they've turned out their debt quite effectively over the last couple of years and really locked in low rates. So what's the concern?
You know, I really worry about risk appetite. We were talking about this in terms of trade and geopolitics. I think that's very present. You know, there were three things that came up last year consistently when talking to companies and talking to investors, both on the institutional and the individual side. And they were, you know, major concerns about where valuations were, anxiety around that, significant anxiety around politics and the impact that politics could have on, you know, market movements. And then I think there was a lot of concern that, you know, significantly higher interest rates were going to, you know, be around the corner and impact companies' earnings. You know, here we are where the anxiety around valuations shouldn't really be there. We've compressed multiples, you know, around the world. We're now at levels that look much more like their five-year averages. You know, politics certainly has been in play, but most companies have been able to continue to operate as usual and are seeing strong growth despite the headline noise. And, you know, as we were saying before, I'm not really concerned that significantly higher rates are going to have an impact on earnings. You know, places I'm watching, though, small and mid-cap, and I'm watching, you know, in particular, those companies that haven't been as smart or are engaging in a new round of investment that is going to be financed by debt.
Kate Moore, it's great to have you with us to get your thoughts. Thank you very much for giving your time to Bloomberg Surveillance on TV and radio through the morning. BlackRock's chief equity strategist.
John Farrow at our studios, Bloomberg 1130 in New York. I'm Tom Keene at 99.1 FM Studios in Washington, D.C. John, just in the distance, I can see the Gucci store, which is always a good and appropriate thing.
Yeah.
Here for the World Bank IMF meetings as well. And also today, a panel with Luigi Zingales of the Booth School in Chicago. Luigi, one of the great jewels, which really folds into the modern debate right now, is a paper by Michael Bordo and Anna Schwartz of years ago on the Chicago history of traditional Keynesian economics. And the title of the paper was called ISLM and Monetarism. And what it amounts to is we set up a geometric structure of how all this economy stuff works in 1936 and 1939 with Hicks. And we dragged it forward to Milton Friedman. Neither of those parties, Hicks, Keynes, Alvin Hansen, or Milton Friedman at Chicago, had to deal with trillion-dollar deficits. How does the fiscal debt fold in to our traditional economic models?
I think they certainly did not have to deal with a deficit of this size, but also they did not have to deal with a deficit of this size in a moment where the level of debt is so high and where the economy is doing relatively well. So I think that what is surprising is not so much that we have a deficit. We had a huge deficit in 2009, was a bigger deficit, but that was in a difficult moment sort of economically. And now we are 9 years into an expansion and the economy is doing relatively well. So I think that increasing the deficit at this moment of the cycle with this level of debt coming in might reduce the ability to do countercyclical fiscal policy when a recession will come.
Can you say that a rising debt and deficit lowers the degrees of freedom that monetary authorities have, whether it's the Italian government or it's Chairman Powell? Does it give you just less choice given an outside shock?
First of all, I will differentiate between the Italian situation, the U.S. situation. The U.S. control its own currency, so they have a flexibility that Italy does not have.
Sure.
This said, I think that what I'm most worried about is the limited ability of the fiscal policy. So when the next recession will come, and one forecast I can make for sure, there will be a recession at some point. I don't know when, but there will be another recession. And we have limited ability to intervene from a monetary point of view, because in the typical recession, right, interest rate drop by 5% point. And where is the space for the monetary policy to act?
Luigi, let me bring in my colleague. He and I have been discussing the World Cup coming up in Russia.
Is there a World Cup?
Who will be there?
I thought there is
no
World Cup.
No,
but there's no World Cup. Yeah.
Well said, Luigi.
Last night in the early evening, I'm talking Brighton Tottenham Premier League football.
Not the World Cup.
With John Farrell. And I go, John, I just don't get it. So let's bring in Mr. Farrell with more important items.
Hey, Professor. Great to speak to you again. We're talking about exhausting fiscal policy. Let's talk about exhausting monetary policy. The Fed has made a move here in the United States in a way that the ECB really hasn't. And Professor, I look at Europe right now with some concern about the next downturn in Europe, and not so much on the fiscal side. A lot of people concerned about that. But on the monetary policy side, with the deposit rate still as negative as it is and the balance sheet as big as it is and growing.
Yeah, I think that if the United States shouldn't cheer, Europe is in a worse situation, because there is no European fiscal policy to know of. And as you said, the monetary policy is basically zero interest rate. So there is not very much room. I think that there is still way to go in the European expansion. So we hope that we don't have a recession soon. But if we had to add one, it wouldn't look pretty.
Well, Professor, the reason I bring this up is because arguably in Europe, we've seen peak growth in terms of the absolute levels of growth that we had at the back end of last year and the beginning of this year. And yet CPI is barely at 1.5%. It's at 1.3% and got revised lower this morning on the continent. So the ECB's got a choice to make now, haven't they, Professor? They can either sort of have their credibility questioned and start moving before they get back to target, or sit here and wait, and ultimately it might never happen.
Yeah, I think that the first thing they need to do is convince that having a 1.3% inflation is too low. You know, in the ECB website is still written that the price stability means to have an inflation below 2%. And some of the ECB board members say below but close to 2%. But others just think that below 2% is fine. So I think that the first job of Draghi is to convince them again that 1.3 is too low and something needs to be done.
I looked, Luigi, at where we are today. I want to save time for our panel today. And I guess I have to do that right now because you've got to get on with your IMF day as well. Professor Zingales, it was a panel. You know, I was thrilled that Madame Lagarde's people called me up. The honor to do the panel with you and Laura Tyson of Berkeley and Mr. Harrington of Edelman. They're profoundly important folks, Edelman, in the measurement of people's moods worldwide with the acclaimed Edelman Trust Barometer. But Luigi, I had no idea when I accepted this panel on trust and resilience, we would have the political discourse of the day. The trust seems to be evaporating towards a new populist state. Is it the same populism nation to nation, or is it really each culturally discrete?
Of course, there are many ways to be dysfunctional. There are many ways to be populist. And I think that there is, however, a common theme. And the common theme is that the elite that tend to be a globalized elite does not appear to be trustworthy. I think that the lack of trust is not fault of the people who don't trust us. It's our fault that we don't appear, and hopefully just appear, maybe. There's also some substance, but we don't appear as trustworthy as we should be, given the responsibilities that we are in charge with.
John, I think that part of this is almost media exhaustion, where you and I are buffeted every single day by the next populist crisis or populist reality, and we almost become numb to it.
Yeah, I'd have to say, have we seen a populist crisis yet? And I ask that because we had the Brexit vote and I don't see a crisis in the economy. And we've had the President of the United States, Donald Trump, walk into the White House and I don't see a crisis in the economy, quite the opposite. I'm just wondering whether we've actually seen that populist crisis that many people forecast but ultimately hasn't materialized.
I think it's building. If you have paid attention to the last Italian elections, I think the results were quite disruptive, and we don't know when we'll have a government. So I think that it's building momentum in different places, and I agree with you, we have not seen the worst yet.
And Professor, I think some people might say that maybe Italy without a government is a better place at the moment. Professor Luigi Zingales, University of Chicago, Booth School of Business Professor in Washington, D.C., with Tom Keane.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
To get to the markets, in the commodity market, it's been a rally that not too many people saw coming, certainly not at this magnitude, up by 8% on Brent year-to-date, up by almost 12% on WTI. To weigh in, I'm really pleased to say that Francisco Blanch has entered the studio, the head of global commodities and derivatives research for Merrill Lynch. Francisco, what happened this year that maybe some people weren't positioned for?
Well, look, I think we've had a meaningful reduction in supply driven by the cartel, OPEC and Russia. Importantly, we've had strong global growth, and that's led to maybe a faster than expected inventory withdrawal as it relates to oil, and that's pushed the price of crude higher. That's one thing. Obviously, metals, as you know, haven't performed as well, and there's another set of issues there. And on the precious side, gold has had a nice run up because I think people are starting to get a little bit nervous about policy tightening, volatility has picked up, and that supported the precious. So there's different reasons driving commodity prices higher, but in general, I mean the strong global growth and the uncertainty about when it's going to peak have been driving the commodity complex.
So we've got three things to work through. One is on oil, and we'll do that first. And then the second part is these sort of idiosyncratic stories around metals like aluminum. And then the third part is ultimately what global policy means for a security, a product like gold. Let's start with oil, Francisco. The geopolitical risk premium that was injected into this market over the last couple of weeks seemingly is going to drain back out. Can we keep prices elevated once that geopolitical risk premium drains back out, if you do believe it will drain back out?
Well, first of all, I think there's a little bit of a geopolitical risk, but not a lot. If you look at the it depends. If you call Venezuela and production falling geopolitical risk, then yes, you have geopolitical risk. But I think that's been the main driver of prices moving higher on the supply side, right? You've had a cartel collective cut, and then you've had a collapse in Venezuelan production that really kicked off starting right around June, July of last year, and it's accelerated into the start of this year, and that's been a big driver of the upward price moving oil prices. So I think the geopolitical risk premium is relatively modest still, and prices could definitely push higher if that geopolitical risk becomes more prominent. But I do think we're going higher anyway. We have an $80 target by the end of the quarter. We think we're going pretty much in a straight line to 80 from here. We have seasonal factors. We have cyclical factors. There's a lot of reasons to believe that in the short run, in the next couple of months, oil prices are going to move higher.
Well, within that is move higher. And if we don't have a memory, Francisco Blanch, of $100 a barrel, it's a terrific bull market in oil. And the vector, as Gartman would say, is from the lower left to the upper right. Why can't oil just drive higher based on a make the global economy a great again economy?
It can, Tom. And I think one of the other issues that's popped out more recently is that even though we're seeing very strong growth in the U.S. and even in Canada, we're starting to hit a lot of transportation bottlenecks here. So much of the supply that was expected to come from North America is getting clogged up in pipes. We've seen differentials to WTI in shale basins like the Permian, so the Midland. Prices have really decoupled from prices in other parts of the U.S. and around the world. Same's happened for Western Canada prices. And that's, I think, going to slow down investment a little bit. So my sense is that we are very reliant on a U.S. infrastructure system that is quite clogged up. And at the same time, the cartel is getting closer to a deal on June 22nd, where they may either extend or at least keep a very, very close, very tight grip on the oil market. Because Saudi Arabia needs it, and also now Russia, with the economic pressures they're facing, they're probably also going to be leaning towards staying in the deal. So that's what's going on in oil.
I look at the going on in oil, and I guess the money question, and John Farrell is better at this than I am, is does it fold over into other commodities? Is oil discrete? Or can Francisco Blanche go long Brazil this morning?
Well, I mean, definitely oil has a lot of spillover effects. To your point, there's going to be if we do break above $80 and start to see a more sustained rally, that's going to have spillover effects. It's going to move into other markets. And what's interesting about it is really that we are seeing some of it already. We've seen finally a recovery in some of the energy equities. We are seeing moves in the MLP sector. So even outside just the crude oil, right? Outside just the outright crude oil price, we're starting to see other sectors reacting, and that's because the back end of the price of oil might even move on a forward basis in the next few weeks.
Francisco, there's this really interesting story in aluminium over the last couple of weeks, and it's an idiosyncratic event that Rusal has been sanctioned by the United States, and ultimately it's raised huge concern about where the supply is going to come from. What is the base case for you guys now looking at the situation in aluminium?
Well, so first thing you have to put in perspective is Rusal is about 6% of the global aluminum market, and that's and obviously that's creating pressure on the price, but we already saw the first round of tariffs adding pressure to aluminum risk premium, and that was a direct effect of the tariff in the U.S. Now, obviously, we are seeing a large chunk of the market being carved out. So we do think aluminum could be going to $3,000 a ton. The pressure on the aluminum price is directly proportional to the tariffs as well as to the sanctions, right? So in our view, we're talking about one of the biggest players in the market. We're talking about a large portion of the supply side being pulled out. Can you imagine if we pulled out 6% of global oil supply?
Yeah. Right?
I mean, that would be, 6% of global oil supply is bigger than Iraq. Iraq is 4.5% of global oil supply, to put it into context. So this is a lot of aluminum, and now aluminum is a much more common ingredient. There is some spare capacity. We're gonna probably restart smelters in parts of the world that had been shut down for a while, but that's the story, right? And you know, the politics have gotten in the way of aluminum here.
Francisco Blanche, great to have you with us and to get that context and perspective. Head of Global Commodities and Derivatives Research for Merrill Lynch.
Right now, he is the pit bull terrier for the Bush family, John Sununu of New Hampshire. He is the mechanical engineer from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Mr. Sununu, Governor Sununu, I can only say that you will always be 55 years old and protective of the Bush family instead of your more august and retired view right now. I want to go back to 1992, and where some will say Mrs. Bush – salvaged the Bush campaign at a speech in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And Mr. Bush was struggling with Mr. Buchanan. And some would say Barbara Bush saved the day. What did she bring to the politics as George Herbert Walker Bush tried to drag the Republican Party towards his Republican Party?
Well, Barbara Bush had a very good political sense. She liked, I think, campaigning in New Hampshire. And every time she came here, she seemed to connect directly with the voters. You know, we're a see-me, touch-me, feel-me kind of campaign state, and she was able to do that quite well. You know, she was sort of very comfortable, and I think that comfortable conveyed a sense of warmth, and that sense of warmth obviously went to the benefit of the president.
There have been criticisms over the years of any number of families. We can take it back. You were not active in the John Adams administration, were you? I think that was even before.
That's the first one. I was around for the second one.
You were around for Quincy Adams. But there's always talk about royal families of American politics. The Kennedys, of course, have been front and center in that debate. Were the Bushes, and was she the queen of a royal family?
Well, you know, they were strong believers in public service, and it was something that they felt an obligation to. They had an active life in the private sector, unlike a lot of the other so-called dynasty families in American politics. All of them, from the president who founded and was one of the early founders and certainly developed the great company, offshore drilling company, Zapata Oil. Jeb certainly had a big private sector life in Florida, and George W., including ownership of the Texas Rangers. So they, as a family, were able to combine private sector, public sector involvement quite effectively. I really do think that they all understood that they wanted to give a little bit back to the system. She certainly instilled that in the kids. They recognized her as the definer of what the family was like, and responded to it. So I think although there was never any stated agenda, there was an implicit you owe the communities you live in, the country you live in, a little bit of payback, and public service was the mechanism of payback.
Governor Sununu, do you recall the first time that you met Barbara Bush?
I think the first time was probably in the 1980 campaign that was not successful for the eventual President George Bush, but I don't remember it specifically, but I really got to know them extremely well after I was elected governor in 82 and he was vice president. They were smart enough to know that if there's any continued ambitions to be president, it is good to develop a good relationship with the governor of New Hampshire. But we became very close friends while I was governor. My wife and I actually spent a couple of nights with them in the vice presidential residence in Washington, and at events for national governors and things like that. So we developed a very close friendship even before the 88 campaign.
What was Barbara Bush like in your relationship with her as the White House chief of staff for George H.W. Bush, serving in 89 to 91?
Yeah. Well, you remember historically there have been some tough relationships between chiefs of staffs and first lady, but I was very lucky. We had a very good relationship. I think she obviously sensed that I was there to have the president's back. She certainly felt that was one of her responsibilities as well. And so we shared this mutual responsibility, and as a result, I think that helped bring us even closer together.
There's a comment that has been published from the late Tim Russert, having made a speech quite a while ago, talking about when you finally left the White House of President George H.W. Bush, that she kind of was someone that you confided in. I'm wondering if you could expand on that.
Well, she was someone I felt very close to, and when I was leaving, we spent two or three occasions talking about, frankly, the good times we had had. I left really on a positive note. I had expected to last about 6 to 9 months, which is what most chiefs of staff last. I lasted in the White House a little over 3 years, and it was very positive. We stayed close during that transition, and we stayed close afterwards. In fact, I came back to the White House a few times and played Ross Perot in the mock debates, and every time I went back, I spent a little time chatting with her. She was really the rock of the family, and even in the White House, she was the rock the president counted on, and those were tough times in the 92 campaigns, and she was there stalwart as she had been in the 88 campaign.
You mentioned the role of the chief of staff, and I'm wondering if you could expand on your thoughts about the current White House chief of staff and some of the issues that Mr. Kelly's probably facing.
Well, I haven't had any time to spend with General Kelly, so my analysis would only be through the press that I've seen, and frankly, that means I probably don't have a real feeling for what's going on down there, so I'm going to pass on that.
Okay. You have been credited with being part of a group of people that had recommended David Souter of New Hampshire as appointment to the Supreme Court of the United States. Do you have any thoughts about that recommendation and the subsequent roles of White House Chiefs of Staff for those kinds of appointments?
Yeah, if you read my book, you'll actually get the real story. I actually ended up supporting Edith Jones in the final selection. David Souter was a great Supreme Court judge in New Hampshire and a terrible Supreme Court judge when he got to Washington. It is a great example, in my opinion, of somebody who lives their life with a singular ambition, and lives their life in order to achieve it, and sometimes when they get there, the person that's at the destination is different than the person that was perceived on the trip, and it's one of the great disappointments in my public life that David Souter ended up being as really different a Supreme Court judge than he sold both the president and all the lawyers that vetted him for the president in that process. Boyden Gray is certainly one of the great conservatives in Washington, and he and his staff were all quite conservative. They were absolutely convinced, reading David Souter's New Hampshire decisions, that this was going to be a good conservative judge, and it turned out otherwise.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, former Governor of New Hampshire, John Sununu, former White House Chief of Staff under President George H.W. Bush, sharing his thoughts and memories of Barbara Bush, former First Lady and matriarch of the Bush family. She died and was 92 years old.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants.
That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.